Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to the Tamar Yonah Show here at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Today, Israel is at war, and yet it's still one of the world's happiest countries. How and why? We're going to talk about that on the show today. Also, Indian Navy does what U.S. Navy dares not try. What can that be? Also, the EU and the Middle East lies again. A little noticed economic cycle. Also, the coming environmental catastrophe. Well, we've been hearing a lot about that. And the state of Mideast war goals. All that on today's show with Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem. He is a researcher, former lecturer at Ben-Gurion University. He's authored over 90 books and 400 research papers on science, history, and more. And he commentates on Mideast and world issues. I want to welcome to the show Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem. Shalom.
Thank you. I apologize ahead of time if I sound a little bit like a frog, but I've had a mild cold yesterday, and that's what remains of it.
Well, you should have a full and speedy recovery.
Oh, recovery is fine. It's just the voice sounds weird.
Okay. All right. So Israel, as everyone knows, is still at war, unfortunately. And yet we are still one of the world's happiest countries. How is that and why?
Okay, well, let's start with the simplest part of that. There's a yearly survey by some organization that I think is part of the UNMEN, the UNUnited Nations, and they do this survey of like 195 countries around the world or whatever they classify as countries this season, and they ask them how happy they are that the index is based upon a series of fundamentals, GDP per capita, life expectancy, social support, freedom, generosity, and corruption, okay? So number one is Finland, and I think Finland has been number one for like 10 years or something like that. So Finland is number one, but they only have fertility of 1.4, so they're very happy, but they're happy to die. Interesting country. Israel, despite being at war, and the survey was taken during the month of October after the war broke out, went up from number 10 position last year to number 5 this year. Now, one should note that Israeli fertility is also growing, and it's well above 3.1 today, which is the highest of any nation across the so-called Western civilization.
And as you've said in other shows, that when a country has a high population rate in the sense of reproduction, it usually means that the people there are very optimistic about their lives.
Well, they're optimistic about the future of their lives. In other words, they feel that their children will have a better life than they had. Mm-hmm. And that's work that was research done by basically. The basic research was done, as far as I'm aware, by David Goldman, who's both an economist and a musicologist, by the way.
And so what is the reasons that they give?
Who? What? I don't understand.
You're saying that we're one of the happiest countries in the world, and you put that with how and why. So what's the
why? Okay. So they say that there are six factors. I read them off. GDP, life expectancy, social support, freedom, generosity, and corruption. So that's the how. Okay, so that's how how it's measured. This happiness index that they've created. That's how it's measured, and so in that sense, Israel is number 5 in the world in terms of what they define as happiness. And why? Why I believe it's because the same thing as we're discussing on the fertility, that the Israeli population basically believes in its future very strongly.
Fascinating. Anything that you want to add to it on your own personal?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there is something. It's sort of an interesting side point, but a rabbi, a well-known rabbi who I personally admire very much, Shmuel Eliyahu, was the chief rabbi of the holy city of Tzfat, wrote just before the Purim holiday that the one of the secrets to the war, particularly because it's occurring during the time of Purim and the holidays, is for people to be happy. Now, he could not have known about this survey beforehand because there wasn't time for him to know when he wrote that thing. But it's very interesting that both this external indexing thingy, whatever it is, and the viewpoint of Torah actually match in this case.
That should give people food for thought, that if it's not so good where you are, if you're Jewish, you can forge a whole new future here and a whole new ancestry here in Israel. And there are perks for coming to Israel. If you're Jewish, you'll get an automatic citizenship, but there's a process involved, of course, and sometimes it can take even a year. So you have to get busy working, but you'll make new friends here. You'll have new family here. You'll have a new future here. Your kids will grow up as Israelis, your grandkids as well. And if you don't have family here, then you can be the anchor that brings them here. You can be the one that says, oh, well, my uncle or my aunt or my grandfather or grandmother or my mom or dad, or, you know, if you're the kid, then you can maybe bring your parents, etc. Someone's always an anchor for someone else. And
on the other hand, you can stay in the United States and die six to 8 years younger.
According to statistics of?
Life expectancy, for one thing. I mean, the life expectancy in Israel grows every year continually. The life expectancy in America has shrunk every year continuously for the last, I think it's 5 or 6 years.
I remember you did it. You did something on that on a past show.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, folks.
And of course, under Biden, it's been shrinking even faster.
Okay, let's go into a little bit more politics and military happenings around the world. You say here that the Indian Navy does what the U.S. Navy dares not try. And what
as everyone knows now, there's a whole business with the Houthis. And since the Houthis are involved, the Somalis, just across the strait, they're involved as well. And so there's a lot of pirating going on. The Houthis basically are pirates, by the way, in case anybody didn't notice it. I mean, basically, it has nothing whatever to do with Israel. They just like taking ships. They always have, as a matter of fact. The Houthis have been pirates only for the last 1,000 years. So, you know, nothing new there. But the Indians, they don't like pirates. And so they sent their navy. And they have a very powerful navy today, a very interesting blue water navy. It's not large, and it's not well known outside of its own home territories in the Indian Ocean and the Arab Gulf. pardon me, my voice again. And so the Indians pulled off a 40-hour rescue mission where they freed a Bulgarian bulk cargo ship held by pirates off Socotra. Socotra, by the way, is a fascinating place. What I'm about to say is all from public publications. Nothing secret here what I'm saying. Okay? Now, Socotra is an island off the southern coast of Yemen, ostensibly owned by Yemen. But according to news reports, it has been controlled by the United Arab Emirates for the last 7 or 10 years. And according to some reports, Israel has a far a distant military base for surveillance and other activities, as it is defined by these publications, on the island of Socotra. Now, the island of Socotra is fascinating. It has unique both flora and fauna not found anywhere else on the world.
Like,
it's a very interesting little island.
Fauna, like, so they, what?
Sorry?
What do they grow there? Like what?
Not what they grow there, what grows there. There are some trees there, for instance, that grow nowhere else, and a few other things.
Okay.
people should be aware, for instance, that Yemen historically, where did its wealth come from? If you go back to the time of, how do you say it in English? Makatshva, is that in English?
I'm unfamiliar with that. How do you spell
one who visited, Amir Shlomo.
You mean the Queen of Sheba?
Ah, Sheba. Okay, yeah, that's the thing. Yes.
Oh, Malkat. Oh, okay, I didn't understand what you said. Okay.
Well, I told you, my voice is weird.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. The wealth of Yemen was based historically on the growing of frankincense and export of frankincense. So that whole area of the world has had out of the ordinary plant life forever. It's always been that way. Socotra is even more strange. So there are things there that grow only on that island and nowhere else in the world. Frankincense, by the way, is no longer grown in Yemen. It is grown in Israel today, but that's besides the point. So all 17 hostages were freed. All 35 pirates were captured. The U.S., one should note, spends 40% of the world's defense budgets, and its military is at best impotent. It's been at war for 80 years. Hasn't won a single war since then. It can't even do anything against these barefoot goat herds in Yemen. It's been trying for months now, and it's been totally incompetent. Kind of scary. The U.S. fears to hold Iran responsible for the actions taken by Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, and about 27 other so-called militias that Iran runs around the world. And they simply, the U.S. military loves getting money. It doesn't like doing much with it.
Okay, well, you know, they have to go by their commander-in-chief, which seems to be showing signs of senility, but...
I don't think that's the case, thank you. I'm sorry. I've said 80 years. This is not 80 years. This imbecile has been in there for 3.5 years, not 80. 80.
Okay. All right.
You know, Biden has nothing to do with the war in Afghanistan. He only lost it.
So the Indian Navy has been successful?
The Indian Navy has been marvelously successful. They've done other things as well. This is just one example. But they've begun to become active. And they're doing wonderful work.
Well,
and they should be congratulated.
Yeah, listen to me. You need somebody policing those waters where those pirates are. Absolutely.
Yes.
And hopefully they're good police.
Hopefully.
All right. The EU, the European Union, and the Middle East lies again, you write.
Yeah. Nothing new here. EU, the so-called European Union, how united it is, I don't really know. They paid Mauritania about 2 years ago. They spent so-called, quote, several million dollars to pay Mauritania to stop immigration from Mauritania to Europe, to the southern European coast. Then last year, they spent $150 million to stop so-called migration from Tunisia. And now they've paid Egypt $8 billion to stop migration from Egypt. So the best thing we can say so far is that Egypt is a much better negotiator than the other two countries were. Of course, that just means that the EU is getting stupider as they go along. They're desperate. They're running out of stolen funds. They don't have anybody to steal from anymore. Now, remember, the EU, one of the major economies of the EU is France. And France has just been cut off at the knees in West Africa. Their main source of the last almost seven decades, their main source of funding for the French government has been funds that they steal from West African countries. But now Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger have all revolted against that.
Yeah.
They're canceling the suzerainty of the French monetary hold that they had on them. They're now talking about uniting together in some sort of confederation, and they've thrown out French troops and U.S. troops, who, again, were in there doing something. Nobody knows exactly what, but they were not doing anything of any value to anybody other than themselves. They certainly were ineffective completely in terms of the excuse that they had for being in there, which was supposedly to fight the terrorists, the jihadist terrorists. Totally ineffective, totally inconsequential. Of course, one doesn't expect anything else from France, because more than a third of the French military are Muslims. Why would they fight their co-religious? So much for the Europe. If we talk just for a moment about the Ukraine war, which is still progressing for some reason, it's still going very badly for the Ukrainians. I think the Russians have been kind of pathetic as well, but Russia has 7 times the population of Ukraine, 10 times the GDP per capita, and 30 times the area of Ukraine. Russia has a GDP of $1.5 trillion, while the U.S. and allies have a GDP of $35 trillion, a 1-to-20 relationship. Yet Russia is still not only winning, but outproducing, outperforming, despite all of the phenomenal sums of money that that the United States and its Western allies, Western European allies, have spent on Ukraine. Russia is still winning the war handily, not quickly, much more slowly than anybody expected, but they are winning, and they're winning constantly. There are very few retreats by Russia over this past 6 to 8 months. They've been going on they've been progressing very steadily. But Biden can now register for himself a tremendous achievement. He can now be said to be as dim-witted as Peanut Brain Carter, as much as a liar as Coward Clinton, and as disconnected a racist as Obama. Now, that's unfortunate. That's his only accomplishment, but he can register that accomplishment. He's beaten all three of them.
You brought up Russia, and I saw this week an article or a news flash that Russia has sent a Pacific fleet, which has entered the Red Sea. That's also where, like, the Houthis are, and is headed toward Yemen, where American and British ships have carried out strikes on the Houthis. And I sent this to you, and I asked you, is this the start of World War III? If you read the Torah, the Bible, you'll see how it says that in the end of days, when this war of Gog and Magog comes, that God is going to pull in the nations by a yoke, like he's going to pull them in. And here you have this October 7th thing that happened, and all the nations are getting involved. And now you've got these major countries with their warships in right next to Israel. So what do you think is happening there?
Well, first of all, we should add that China has warships there as well. So you're saying Russia, China, India, U.S., U.K. I think Chile is not there yet. Maybe we'll talk to Chile. They're kind of missing. We're missing the Chileans.
So really, like, what do you think is happening there?
I think that we're in big trouble. I think the world is in really, really big trouble. I mean, look, if we look at it from a very let me try to be as objective as any human being can try to be, okay? Belisarius was the last general of Byzantium. He was not defeated because of external enemies. He was defeated by internal enemies. Putin, as far as I can tell, is the last European Christian leader. All the others are either marshmallows or morons. All of them. So Putin is being defeated not by an external enemy. Putin is being defeated by his fellow Christians. By the way, Putin, despite being a scion of the KGB, is a very devout Christian. People in the United States are probably not aware of that. He is a quite devout Christian, quite devoted Christian, and very devoted to his people. You can hate him all you want, but that is part of his basic psychological makeup. Remember, Russia does not have military patrolling the subway system in Moscow. The United States has military patrolling the subway system in New York because the crime there is so bad that even the New York Police Department, historically probably the best municipal the police department in the world, are incompetent and can't get the job done. And the crime rate there is horrendous. Even for New York, it's horrendous. And New York has always had a horrible crime rate. So Putin is not a nice person. We can all agree with that. But he is an effective leader. And he is being fought by every other Christian leader on the planet just about. So something here is sick. Something here is very sick. And it's not going to get well by itself.
I want to bring it back to, again, with all the nations, well, no, I shouldn't say all, but many of the superpowers of the world being drawn to the nearby Israel here. And to follow up on that, because that's what goes along with the Torah, with the Bible, and that is that they're on Channel 13 News yesterday, they had headlines. I don't know if I sent this to you, but it is... is Israel on the way to being isolated in the world? And after that, another headline stating Israel is alone. Where has its support, has world support for it gone? So we learn in the Bible that Israel is a nation that dwells alone. And we know that in the end of days, the nations of the world are going to come upon us, but we're going to win in the end. Do you see all this lining up? Do you see God setting the stage for all of this to happen?
Well, as you know, I have a library at home, and among the other things I have a significant number of books about Israel, the state of Israel, the land of Israel, the history of Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And I have about 10 books here that predict the imminent defeat of Israel, and the earliest one of them is from 1970. So the imminent defeat of Israel has been predicted more times than we can probably count, by more people than we can probably count of, and it's always been a nonsense prediction. Do I think this is going to happen now? Are we really going to be isolated? No chance. Let me put it really simply. In 1948, we managed with a microscopic population defeat an Arab force which was more than 100 times our size. More than 100 times our size. In 1948, there was no country in the world that was dependent on Israel for its either for its population or its for defense. Today, there are tens of countries around the world that depend on Israel for the defense equipment. It's Philippines, Singapore, India, Argentina. The list is very long. So, are we actually going to be alone? No. Will we be alone in terms of the Western media, which is garbage in any case? Absolutely. Do I care that we'll be alone in the Western media? I couldn't care less.
Yeah, but a lot of the left in Israel, unfortunately and sadly, believe that Israel needs the support of the international community. It needs the support of America. We have to do what Biden says, et cetera, et cetera.
I think you're defining the problem, not the solution.
Well,
the problem is that they think that. The problem is not that whether that's true or not.
Which is not true.
Of course not.
We say it in our prayers daily.
And we not only say it in our prayers, but I'm saying, you know, forget for a moment the spiritual part of it. Look at the practical. You know, can the United States exist today without Israel? Where does all these AI chips come from? They all come from here. Every one of them. Every one of these companies that the people are talking about AI, they're all from here. They're all from Israel. Where are all these chips manufactured? In Israel. Where are they designed? In Israel. How much of American defense technology comes from Israel. A very large amount. They steal it, but it still comes from here. Yes, we get our airplane platforms from them, but what was his name? James Baker III, the foul-mouthed former Secretary of State of the United States, said, every Israeli F-16, and I'm quoting him, not word for word, but very close, every Israeli F-16 is worth six American F-16s. So, yes, we get the platform from them. But what we do with them is something else altogether. That was James Baker, who despised Israel totally.
All right, a little noticed economic cycle.
cute. Okay, I'm going to be a little bit unkind at the moment. Some time ago, I recommend that people look at gold in terms of investing. At the time, it was $1,550 per ounce. It's now $2,240 per ounce, 42% in 20 months, approximately. Okay? So the major historical indicator for whether the price of gold is sustainable is, how does it look in terms of the various currencies? Because gold is always quoted in American dollars. What we found over the past several months is that gold has gone up in every single currency in which it is traded today anywhere in the world. It's the yuan, it's rubles, it's whatever. It doesn't matter what currency you're talking about, the price of gold has gone up and continues to go up. So silver has been dormant for quite some time now. It's very strange, but it's 60% of demand for silver today is from industry, not as a precious metal, but as an industrial metal. Mm-hmm. 2/3 of a billion ounces of deficit. In other words, more is used than mined every year. In other words, people are selling the silver that they have stored. Remember, every gigawatt of solar power uses 500,000 ounces of silver in its manufacture. And none of that is recyclable. None of it. Zero. The U.S. debt rises by $1 trillion today every 100 days. $1 trillion every 100 days. As the dollar weakens, gold rises and supplies wane, because almost every central bank around the planet today is accruing gold or other precious and or other precious metals, mostly gold. Usually, historically, the Middle East was a prime driver of the political processes that control these things, these basic commodities like gold, silver, oil, etc. But today, that's not the case. The Middle East is not the driver today. And this goes directly back to your previous question, Tamar. The Middle East is not a prime driver in the price of oil. It's not a prime driver in the price of precious metals. This is the first time this has happened for a very long time. So what are the prime drivers? We don't really know. What we can notice is that 2000 was a U.S. presidential election year. 2000 was an economic issue, large economic problem. 2008 was a U.S. presidential election year. 2008 was a large economic problem around the world. 2020 was a U.S. presidential election year. It was a large economic issue around the world. 2024 is a U.S. presidential election year. Remember something very, very basic in terms of politics. Historically, the best, easiest way to re-election is an October crisis. We are in, pardon me, we are in the month of March right now. We are actually on the cusp of March and April. Half a year from now is October. What's going to happen in terms of economics in October? None of us know, except maybe a few who are planning something. But I will save you. The primary way to re-election is to shout, "We saved you!" My warning to everybody that's listening, watch, listen, and learn. Something's going to happen, I believe. There's an economic cycle there that's not being traced by most people. If you value your family, you should watch this very carefully.
All right. And again, always speak with your financial advisor to figure out what's best for you personally. The coming environmental catastrophe.
This is fascinating, particularly since this is the...
Don't tell me.
Sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
I said, don't tell me it's global warming and climate change.
No, those are just jokes. And they're not real.
Thank you.
Okay. We just saw this past week this catastrophe in the city of Baltimore, which was unbelievable. Anyone who actually saw the footage of what actually went down there, I didn't mean that as a pun, I'm sorry. I did not mean that as a pun. What actually happened there was amazing. But let's take a step back before that, okay? The U.S. electrical grid is in really, very dire condition right now. A recent survey by Princeton University, which is a very well-known university. Remember, it had such luminaries like Albert Einstein as part of the university at one time? A bit of research done by Princeton University to return the U.S. electrical grid to the levels of utility that it had pre-2000. That was to go back in time a quarter of a century will need a $3.5 trillion investment. The U.S. maladministration, I will not bless them by calling them administration, not administering anything, is attempting to implement demands for 70% electric vehicles within 8 years. Utterly ridiculous demand. Utterly ridiculous. Physically impossible to implement.
Someone's asleep at the wheel.
Sorry?
Someone is asleep at the wheel.
Is that a pun?
Yeah. Well, it's a saying.
First of all, the electricity infrastructure that will be possible to support that simply does not exist. And again, $3.5 trillion to go back a quarter century, not to advance the grid, but to return it to where it was a quarter century ago. That's $3.5 trillion. To get to the point where it will be able to support 70% of electric vehicles would demand at least three times that amount. That cash simply does not exist. 80% of electrical vehicle components are made in China. 54% of the electric vehicle batteries are made in China. To implement this, the grid needs to be massively enhanced. In some states, for instance, in Georgia, the state of Georgia estimates that to implement 70% electrical vehicles, listen to this number very carefully, they would need to enhance their electric grid by 1,700%.
Wow.
That's not going to happen, people. So the demand for 70% electrical vehicles, that's tooth fairy land. Now add on that every new artificial intelligence data center needs electricity equivalent to a city of 150,000 people. AI demands enormous quantities of energy. In parallel, this administration has made new nuclear plants basically impossible to implement. If these electric demands are attempted in any realistic manner, this will cause a total collapse of the United States electrical grid, and with that, with the entire environment of the United States. This will collapse the environment of continental United States.
You won't be able to charge your cell phone.
You won't be able to charge your cell phone. You won't be able to get food on your table.
I'm joking. That's the first thing that people are going to think about. And you know what? I think that a lot of people think it's not going to happen here. This is America. But, you know, already in South Africa, which was a pretty modern state in Africa, has what's called load shedding. And every single day they're having their electricity go out for hours while they try to supply electricity to the rest of the country. By the way, even in Israel, they're talking about on the news, not lately, but a couple of weeks ago, anticipating a full-out war with Hezbollah and anticipating that Hezbollah would try to aim for our infrastructure, meaning our, you know, power, electricity, etc., that they could aim for our power grids, our electric grids, and there could be the Israeli population could be cut off for even up to 3 weeks, they say, of...
Let me give you some facts about that.
Please do.
I mean, clearly what you're saying is correct, but the Israeli electric grid is highly distributed. It's the most distributed electric grid in the world. We have large power plants and small power plants. There are only a small number of very large power plants, but they are backed up by a very large number of small power plants that are geographically distributed. So while the electric grid could be hit, that would probably cause a lot less damage than people think, but much more dangerous in terms of infrastructure is the water grid in Israel. Because remember, 80% of our water is desalinated water.
Today, 80.
So if they were to hit the desalination plants, that would be much more dangerous than the actual electric plant. By the way, next to every desalination plant, there is also an electric generating plant, because desalination demands a great deal of energy.
By the way, I want to tell people how impressive it is that Israel has such a thing. Remember, we were a desert for so long until we started coming back and turning the desert into green. But the fact that we have been able to invent something where we can just take seawater so efficiently and such a large scale for the entire country just about, is very, very impressive to me.
Well, it is very impressive. It's impressive not just technologically. It's impressive, first of all, managerially. I mean, in terms of management, that's a phenomenal achievement. Phenomenal achievement. I mean, you can dislike the present ruling party, but there's no way to avoid it that everything concerning our infrastructure stability. And Israel Electric Company, I mean, you can complain about all sorts of things in terms of their salaries and things like that, but it's one of the highest regarded electric companies on the planet today in terms of technological advancement and their capabilities. It's very, very well done. They're not nice people, but they're very, very good at their job. Very good at their job. I think there's something like three or four countries that surpass us in terms of downtime and things and other measurements like that.
All right, and let's go for the last topic of the...
Just a moment, a little bit more here that we need to talk about. I want to go back to the Baltimore disaster.
Okay.
I think the Baltimore disaster, it's a fascinating incident what occurred there in terms of just intellectually fascinating. This massive cargo ship, remember, the cargo ship was carrying more than 4,000 containers. Fortunately, very few of them were hazardous materials. By the way, I listened to an interview today with the governor of Maryland. I've never heard of him before. I don't know anything about the man in terms of background or politics or anything like that, so I'm not making any comment. But I must say that he spoke very well. He spoke professionally. He spoke knowledgeably. I was very impressed with this. Only one interview that I've ever seen of him, but what I saw was very positive. That's good to know that there are some reasonable people out there somewhere. I forget the man's name, and I apologize to anyone listening from Maryland. But
I want to add in that we're very sorry for the tragedy that happened there. Our hearts are with
the tragedy was horrible. But what's fascinating from my standpoint as a person who's spent many decades in the area of system reliability is the way the bridge collapsed. Now, this is an old bridge. It was built in 1976. So one can expect that maybe the infrastructure wasn't as advanced as it ought to have been. But hitting one pylon should not have, as far as I can tell, I'm not a civil engineer, but I have a lot of experience in engineering and in system reliability. I do not understand why the entire bridge collapsed by hitting one pylon.
I've seen that there's already questions going around about that. I don't want to say conspiracy theories because then it totally disavows, gives a little credence to the questions, legitimate questions that people might have. But I just want to say I've already seen questions like that. How could this bridge have fallen with just one column?
One pylon.
Pylon. Thank you. Yeah. So, but
yeah, the incident is much more complex than it appears on the surface.
Yeah, but in any case, again, our hearts are out to all the victims. It's a terrible tragedy.
Oh, the victims are just so it's so terrible because, of course, none of them had anything to do with this. We don't know anything about the people on the ship itself. Someone said that the master of the ship is Ukrainian. I don't know if that has any bearing on anything. I don't know. But they're supposed to be. Baltimore is a very major harbor for America, so there should have been a pilot on the ship, piloting the ship, a harbor master piloting the ship who knows the harbor well. How could it have hit that pylon? I mean, this is not something that suddenly appeared. It's something that's very well known.
Well, again, as I said, there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. So
this is a very complex issue. Do not expect quick answers. They're estimating that the repairs will cost many trillions of dollars today.
All right.
Again, it's not clear to me where that money will come from.
I guess they'll have to go to war. I'm joking. Okay, last topic. The state of the Middle East war goals.
Okay. Now, as everyone knows, we are at war. Iran initiated the war via its proxy, Hamas. Iran had two major goals in this war. They had other goals as well, but I'm saying two major immediate goals. The one was to halt the process of normalization with Saudi Arabia. That goal failed completely, but they did slow it somewhat. They failed to halt it. That's very clear. MBS has made it very clear that that has not halted it. But they have slowed it down because he can't act on it right now, obviously. And the second thing was they wanted to halt the trade corridor, which had been declared just 1 month before between India, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Europe. And they totally failed at that. People should be aware where all this is coming from. One of the problems here is that, you know, you're hearing all sorts of things like the B&B morons, Biden Blinken morons, keep on saying, well, they want Abbas to take over Gaza after he was thrown out completely, of course. But that's besides the point. They don't care about people. They just care about what they want. Okay, so March 10th, not too long ago, just, you know, three weeks ago, there was a survey conducted by a gentleman by the name of Shikaki, who happens to be the most well-regarded surveyor, or is that what the word, surveyor? That doesn't sound right. Person who does surveys, whatever it's called. The most well-regarded person in that profession in the so-called Arab-Palestinian milieu conducted a survey. And this is March 10th, and the Arabs were asked, A, was the decision to massacre a correct decision? It's a reasonable question to ask people. 71% replied positively. Yes, it was the right decision. Is Hamas doing a good job? 70% said yes. Do you approve of a bus? 14% said yes. 61% prefer Sinwar. So anybody out there like Blinken, who has the brains of a teddy bear, who's ripped, I think, I don't know, anyway, has the brains of a teddy bear, nobody really expects Abbas to be able to take over. Right now, it seems to be a sort of a race between Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. We don't want either of them, of course, but that's besides, nobody's asking us. On October 8th, I remind you, Tamar, that the day after the war began, we had a show, and I stated there that a strong Israeli response would strengthen the Abraham Accords.
Yes.
And a weak response would collapse them. So far we've seen a strong strong response, and indeed the accords have been strengthened, have been enhanced. And we see that Saudis are even more frightened by Hamas than they are of anything else. Of course, they're also frightened by Biden, but not in any positive sense. Israel's response has calmed Saudi fears very much. Israel is regarded by them today as being a reliable potential partner. Remember, what Saudis fear more than anything else right now is Iran. And they are willing to do a lot to avoid being taken over by Iran, because they know that if Iran does take over, the entire House of Saud will be slaughtered. And that's, by the way, that's 40,000 people. The House of Saud, the ruling house of Saudi Arabia, consists of about 40,000 people, 40,000. Hmm. As I said before, MBS will wait for things to calm down, because, you know, it just doesn't want to do things in a manner that's too crass.
Yeah.
But he needs us now more than ever, and he's aware of that. Israel's goals, on the other hand, one was to de-arm Hamas. I differentiate between de-arm and disarm. Disarm means leave Hamas intact, but have them without arms. No, we de-arm them. In other words, they don't have arms, physical arms. They don't have arms, they don't have legs, they don't have gonads. So we've achieved about 75% of that thing. I don't know if people are aware of what happened in last week in the North Gaza, in the remains of the hospital there. Hospital is sort of in double quotation marks there.
Right.
Where there
you
were,
mean Hamas
there were,
attack base.
A main Hamas attack base. Over 800 operatives were captured. Over 800 were captured. Many hundreds were killed. That is an entire battalion of fighters were at that hospital. An entire battalion. That's a phenomenal number to be taking shelter in that building. And again, the European Union went ballistic over trying to protect these fighters. And this is one of the reasons why MBS is so happy now to do business with Israel. If Israel is as cowardly as America, then they don't need us. They have plenty of cowards around. So 75% of that first objective we have succeeded in achieving. 25% we still need to achieve. There are still some battalions that need to be destroyed. They are in Rafa right now, and we'll see what happens with that. The Abraham Accords are intact, as I mentioned. The trade corridor is intact. They've both been enhanced. We have not yet released hostages. We released 42% of the hostages that were taken. 42% of the hostages that were taken. Despite the ramblings of traitor Schumer, quote, "The United States will have no choice but to play a more active role in shaping Israeli policy by using our leverage to change the present course." Schumer's not only a traitor, he's a moron. He's a total idiot.
Well, you know what they say, man plans and God laughs. Man proposes, but God disposes.
Yeah, but first of all, you have to have a man to opposed. I mean, this is not a man. This is a jerk. This is, I'm not saying man as opposed to woman. I'm saying man as opposed to a nothing.
Well, it's a good wake up call for all of these people who feel that they can rely on another country for their protection, and you really can't, because as they say, countries don't have friends; they only have interests.
We've talked about that.
I know.
I disagree with that statement completely.
Okay.
Countries have friends.
You can disagree. You have a right to disagree. You have a right to your opinion. I respect that.
But that's what
I see in history. That's what I see with everything. In any case, any last words you want to say before we end the show?
Before I croak some more with my voice, my strange,
I know. Feel better.
Voice.
I know you've been sick. Feel better.
I'm feeling okay. It's just my voice sounds crazy to me. That's all.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show. There's a lot of topics that we've covered, actually. And here in Israel, I just want to say we are still preparing for war with the Hezbollah. As I understand from a contact up north, that Israel's already preparing some underground parking garages with cots and emergency preparations in case there's any severe bombing from Hezbollah, because most of the buildings and apartments, et cetera, that are up there are really not new. So they don't have safe rooms. The people there are not protected. We still have tens of thousands of Israelis that are homeless, that have had to flee their homes.
60,000.
Thank you for that. 60,000.
I should add, by the way, that's something that people aren't aware of, that we have several hospitals in Israel that are completely operable underground, and I will not say which hospitals.
Right.
But they are there's more than one, and not just in the north.
Right.
That can operate completely, not operate in terms of operating theater, but complete operations underground, completely protected. We have several hospitals.
Israel may have not been prepared on October 7th, but I think that the country is pretty much got its act together in preparation for what we expect will happen or could happen up north. And we have to pray. And we have to say for our leadership, which we may like or may not like, that we pray that they have the wisdom and the courage to do the right thing. Thank you, Dr. Mordechai Ben-Menachem, for being with us.
Thank you.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.